From Minnesota to Tennessee, Nebraska to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Heritage Foundation has released its annual Index of Economic Freedom. Where does the United States stand? Terry Miller from Heritage is here with the answer. States across the nation are redrawing their congressional district lines, and the process isn't going well. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. With prices surging at the pump, the idea of a gas tax holiday is floating around Congress. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to explain the impact on efforts to repair the nation's roads and bridges. And some provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are due to expire in coming years. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council says they should be made permanent. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Heritage Foundation each year conducts a survey and issues an Index of Economic Freedom, ranking nations worldwide. Here to talk about this year's index is Terry Miller. He is a former United Nations ambassador who is now a visiting fellow for economic freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Ambassador Miller, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ambassador, the Index of Economic Freedom, why has the Heritage decided to put together this index every year?
We've been doing this for 28 years now, and the reason is because we found that economic freedom, the various principles and policies based on economic freedom, are highly correlated, highly relevant to how well economies do and how prosperous people's lives are in countries. The countries with greater economic freedom have much faster economic growth rates. They have much higher incomes. They do a better job protecting the environment. They have better health. On all kinds of economic and social indicators, we find that if you have more economic freedom, you do better on those. So what we're trying to do is point out how governments and how people can live more prosperous and happier lives. That's the whole purpose of this.
Tell us a little bit about the methodology, Terry. How do you put together this index? What are the components?
We try to have as comprehensive a view of economic freedom as possible, and we have 12 separate factors that we score independently. Those are things like property rights or corruption in government. We look at tax rates. We look at the level of government spending. We look at the regulatory environment. How controlled are businesses, and not just businesses, but workers as well? Do they enjoy labor freedom? And finally, we look at the openness of markets. Is it really a free market? Is it possible to trade freely? Are there any restrictions on investment that slow down innovation or growth? And what's the banking system like? Do people have access to credit and financing for their ideas, their businesses that they want to create? So we put all that together. We average all those individual scores, and that gives an overall economic freedom score.
I would venture to guess that most people listening would say, well, the United States probably leads the world in economic freedom, do we?
Boy, if only that were true. There was a time when the United States led the world. We were very close to the top of the index in the early days of the index, but we've had really a steady decline, certainly for the last 15 years or so. And now we rank this year 25th in the index in terms of economic freedom.
25th, that's pretty far down the list. So if the United States is 25th on this list on the Index of Economic Freedom, tell us a little bit about who tops the list. What are the top three or four countries, and why are they at the top?
The top countries, Singapore is a small island state, and it's a little bit difficult to compare that directly to the United States, but there are many other countries that are more like us at the top of the index. It's Singapore, Switzerland, New Zealand is up there. Australia is near the top of the index. Luxembourg, Canada outranks the United States, which I find very distressing. But congratulations to our northern neighbors. And you'd never know it from the current news, of course. But still overall looking long term, Canadians enjoy more economic freedom than Americans. So it's really very distressing to see not only the place of the United States, but the trend. We're gradually declining, sometimes sharply declining, over a rather long period. And we've got to get that turned around.
Let us drill down a bit on that, Terry. And why is it? What are the factors that are contributing to this decline of economic freedom of the United States?
The primary factor for the United States is excessive government spending. And one of our factors that we call fiscal health, which is a combination of government debt and government deficits. And the United States ranks very, very poorly on this, one of the worst in the world on this factor. And, you know, this year and in the last couple of years, we've had almost $3 trillion government deficits. That's money we're borrowing from the rest of the world, but also from our future, from our children and from our grandchildren. It's going to have to be paid back. It's a contributor to the inflation that we're seeing right now. We're likely to see a decline in the value of the dollar. So we really have to get government spending under control. We need some discipline in Washington, and we need to live within our means. We need our government to live within its means.
In terms of regulation, did we in fact make any progress in reducing regulations under the Trump administration? And has there now been a reversal of that trend?
Yes, we did make progress in the Trump administration and regulatory efficiency. And some of that is still with us, but now we're starting to see a decline, particularly in labor freedom. We've seen a rather sharp decline since then. And obviously, as the administration starts to increase its the regulatory burden on businesses, we're going to see a decline there. It hasn't really shown up in our numbers yet on the business side, but it certainly has showed up on the labor side.
On the flip side, give us an idea of the three or four countries at the bottom of this list, those who have the least economic freedom.
Well, at the very bottom is North Korea, where there's virtually no freedom at all. They have a completely controlled, government-controlled socialist economy. And then a couple of countries in the Americas, Venezuela and Cuba, are right at the bottom of the list. And this should really be a lesson for Americans that talk about how they want to move towards a socialist or communist organization of our economy. These countries that have done that have seen their economies collapse. They've impoverished their people. There's horrible degradation in all three of those societies. And it's because of the bad policies that their governments have put in place.
We have been talking with Ambassador Terry Miller. Terry is a visiting fellow for economic freedom at the Heritage Foundation. Terry, tell us just a little bit about Heritage. Also, a web address where folks can go to read the latest index of economic freedom.
The Heritage Foundation is a research and an educational institution. It's a think tank. If you want to know more about the Index of Economic Freedom, you can go to heritage.org/index, and you'll have the whole book there. It's a 500-page long book, but you can pick and choose what you want to look at, and you can learn more about the United States and other countries.
Ambassador Terry Miller from the Heritage Foundation. Terry, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth. We have some key races taking place around the country. We're going to talk mainly the political landscape this week. Scott, good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Scott, as we all know, we had the census in 2020. Now every state has to redraw congressional district lines. It is the start of the political season in many states. The time for candidates to pass petitions, to get signatures, to get ballot access is or should be underway. As you look around the country, how is this redistricting process proceeding? Is it getting done in a timely manner?
Well, what you've seen is a lot of state legislatures pass new congressional lines, and the legal fights have begun in a lot of these states. Lines have been suspended through litigation, and basically that complicates where these folks that are running for the House of Representatives are ultimately going to lay down their stake of claim on a congressional district and where they want to actually represent people. Some people know, listen, I'm absolutely running in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for example, right? That's my hometown. Whatever happens, this is going to be my district. In other instances, because of the partisan voter index, the PVI, in these new congressional districts, it can make or break whether or not a district is a swing district, a safe district for Democrats or Republicans, or if it can be a part of maybe a wave election. And so that's why it might be attractive to top-tier candidates. And throughout the country, you're seeing a lot of folks that are still getting into races. Some filing deadlines have passed in various states as well. But in other states, you're watching candidates just really say they're running for the House of Representatives, raising a ton of money, and it's still up for discussion exactly where they're going to run to represent in the United States House of Representatives. So looking at big states, especially states like North Carolina, they were supposed to have their Republican primary on March 8th. That's been pushed back into the middle of May at least earliest, and we're seeing a bunch of proposed maps come out of the state legislature this week. And that was actually a little bit of a problem. Late last week, the Club for Growth PAC decided to move ahead and make an endorsement for a young man named Bo Hines in North Carolina. Bo is going to certainly be in one of the competitive districts in North Carolina, either through a retirement or through reapportionment. But following that, the state legislature put forward a different map that actually jeopardizes one of the best conservatives in all of America, a guy named Dan Bishop. And so the Club for Growth PAC decided this week to announce an endorsement for Dan Bishop as well. He has been a steadfast conservative, great member of the House Freedom Caucus. He's on the House Freedom Caucus's board, and we think that Bishop has got quite a future ahead of him as a conservative leader in Washington.
Looking around the country, we, of course, had reapportionment, which is where the number of congressional districts in each state was changed based upon population trends and as revealed by the recent census. Those numbers got benefited marginally Republicans. But as we see in some of these deep blue states, Illinois, New York, how is the process of redistricting proceeding relative to heavy gerrymandering, particularly in blue states?
Illinois and New York are the best examples of liberal state legislatures taking steps to crowd out Republican districts. And especially in New York, you're running into a situation where several Republican districts are being gerrymandered out to be safe Democrat districts. And that will mean that some of these Republicans from New York are going to be running against each other, and others might have to hang it up. It's always a sort of a political tug of war when you're laying claim to an area that both members of the House could represent. And so that's something that you have to watch. You have to watch how various donors react to those situations and whether or not there's a political movement that supports these candidates in areas that they haven't previously represented.
Looking around the country then, Scott, we do have all these U.S. Senate races. Of course, states don't get their district lines redrawn. The state boundaries always stay the same. Just a very quick high-level overview. How are those races going this year? We have a 50-50 Senate. Are Republicans in good shape? Where everybody talks about a red wave. Is that still a possibility with the Senate?
Well, what I would say in one word is those races are competitive. In a lot of these big Republican states, Republicans have to defend more Senate seats than the Democrats by a pretty sizable margin. And so we've got competitive states that Republicans are retiring in places like Missouri, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Alabama. And then you've got incumbents that are going to be in tough races. It's always going to be a close race in Florida for Marco Rubio. Just given what that state is like in terms of being, you know, I think it's a lean Republican state now, especially after Donald Trump has been successful in the state and Ron DeSantis, obviously, in his race in 2018. And DeSantis is also up for re-election in the governor's race there in Florida. Then you have the pickup opportunities that Democrats have recently won in states like Georgia and Arizona. Obviously, they've held that seat in Nevada for a while, but we feel very good about our chances.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Today we talked about the political arm of the Club for Growth with Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action. We have over 500,000 members of the Club for Growth from all 50 states in the country. And you can actually sign up for free at our website, clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Normally, tax cuts are a good idea, but a gas tax holiday, meaning a suspension of federal gas taxes, would provide little relief at the pump while cutting off a vital revenue stream for road and bridge repairs. Eric Baim of Reason Magazine explains.
Inflation continues to be a major economic and political story, and now a few politically vulnerable Democrats are proposing an idea to suspend the federal gas tax. Yes, have a federal gas tax holiday until the end of the year. Of course, that means until after the midterms. And while I'll admit that it's quite amusing to see Democrats discover the idea that cutting taxes can be good for regular Americans, I think there's at least a couple of good reasons to be skeptical of this particular plan to cut this particular tax. And that's what we're going to take a close look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. If you've been out driving around or had to fill up your gas tank recently, you've probably noticed that gas prices are quite a bit higher than they used to be. In fact, according to AAA, the average price per gallon in the U.S. is now just a hair above $3.50. Depending on where you live, it could be actually a lot higher than that, but that national average is about a dollar more than what drivers were paying at this time last year. And so we've started to hear President Joe Biden making some vague promises of taking government action to try and curb these high gas prices. Just this past week, he said that he was going to, quote, work like the devil to bring gas prices down. Now, that's a little bit of a bizarre sentiment because I think it really overstates the president's role in setting gas prices to begin with, though it's certainly understandable why the White House is worried about this. Either rightly or wrongly, gas prices are often treated as a proxy for the country's economic health. And there are two big factors driving gas prices higher right now. The first is just a simple supply and demand issue, like most things dealing with prices in the economy. Like just about any other commodity, crude oil experienced a bust during the low point of the pandemic, and now prices are booming because global demand has surged. Now, there's not much that the president or you or I or anyone can do about those global supply and demand issues. In response to high gasoline prices back in November, you may recall that Biden authorized the largest ever release of crude oil from America's strategic reserve, about 50 million barrels of oil. And that did temporarily lower prices by a few cents nationally. But of course, that's a short-term fix. And 3 months later, it's basically been forgotten because that's just a small short-term dip in prices. The second factor driving up prices is inflation. And we're seeing inflation across the entire economy right now. Prices are up 7.5% over where they were a year ago. And fuel prices have seen much larger increases. Gasoline prices are actually 40% higher than they were in January of 2021, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. A lot of that is due to the supply and demand issues that we just talked about, but at least some of it is a reflection of widespread, persistent price inflation in the economy as a whole. What I mean by that is that a dollar today would buy less gasoline than it did a year ago, even if everything else were equal, even if you didn't have these sorts of larger problems. So Biden does have some control over that, over inflation. Of course, it's a little too late to do anything about it, because pretty much every economist who reviewed Biden's $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan before Congress passed it in March of 2021 warned that dumping that much new money into an already recovering economy was a recipe for inflation. And it turns out those economists were right. There's no way to undo that spending now, so we kind of just have to wait for it to cycle through and wait for inflation to subside. But unfortunately, the White House and some congressional Democrats now appear to be mulling a plan to attack high gas prices in a way that could cause maybe a short-term price dip, but ultimately might make inflation worse in the long run. Senators Mark Kelly and Maggie Hassan, they are Democrats from Arizona and New Hampshire, respectively, have introduced a bill to temporarily suspend the federal gas tax through the end of the year. While the Biden administration has not yet signaled its support for the bill, specifically the Washington Post and other outlets report that officials are debating it behind the scenes, they're at least interested in the idea. A gas tax holiday would mean not paying the 18 cents to the federal government that you pay for every gallon of gas that you put in your car. And like I said at the top of the segment here, it's definitely encouraging to see Democrats, and maybe a little amusing too, to see Democratic lawmakers openly admit that cutting taxes is a way to help ordinary Americans by simply letting people keep more money in their wallets. That's not an idea we usually hear from them. But as a means of lowering gas prices or curbing inflation, I think a gas tax holiday is almost certain to fail. But before I explain why, just a little caveat. There are not many people who dislike taxes more than me. I do not like paying taxes. But if we have to pay taxes, then a gas tax is pretty much the ideal way to do it. It's a flat user fee. You pay 18 cents per gallon. So the people who consume more gasoline pay more taxes, and that revenue is directed straight into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. It doesn't go into the budget where politicians can spend it on whatever they want. So it's a flat, fair tax that goes directly to pay for the thing that it's supposed to pay for, roads and bridges and other transportation projects. So suspending the gas tax would blow an estimated $20 billion hole in the Highway Trust Fund at a time when that fund is already just about 5 years away from insolvency, according to some calculations. And that hole would have to be filled sooner or later, either by raising taxes later or by transferring revenue in from somewhere else or by reducing the number of projects that the Highway Trust Fund will fund in the long term. And if you're not cutting spending, of course, then cutting taxes doesn't really count for anything. The more immediate problem, however, is that if the gas tax holiday does what it's meant to do, that is reduce prices at the pump, then the White House will have an even bigger problem, because lowering prices enough to get them noticed would probably translate into greater consumption of gasoline. When prices go down, people buy more. And that means you're likely to see, well, actually more inflation. Higher prices are a signal to consumers to consume less. Though there are obvious political incentives for the White House and congressional Democrats to try to lower prices artificially, and not just gas prices, but other prices too, then those same higher than normal prices are the market's way of working out the ongoing disconnect between supply and demand that's driving inflation. Instead of letting that mechanism work, any attempt to lower prices artificially will only make the situation worse by stimulating demand. And remember, a gas tax can't increase the supply of gasoline. Cutting the gas tax won't do that either. So while cutting the gas tax may have political appeal, and while it may save drivers a few cents at the pump for the rest of the year, conveniently timed to expire just after the midterms, I'll note, it would move the rest of the economy in probably the wrong direction, actually making inflation potentially worse and creating budget problems that Congress, I don't trust them to solve in the long term. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of everything that's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was responsible for igniting economic growth, which is why the act should be made permanent. So says Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As the economy continues to suffer the effects of inflation, continuing the benefits of the Trump tax cuts, also known as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, is now more important than ever. 23 provisions of these 2017 tax cuts directly related to individual income taxes are set to expire between now and 2025. These provisions include critical changes such as reductions in personal income tax rates, the near doubling of the standard deduction, and the substantial reduction of the hated alternative minimum tax, or AMT. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 proved to be a huge boost for all Americans, not just billionaires, as Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi erroneously predicted. Prior to government-mandated economic shutdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, signed into law by President Donald Trump, spurred steady economic expansion and allowed the spirit of entrepreneurship to flourish while creating new jobs and opportunities for millions of Americans. More than 100 million American taxpayers from all income groups, but especially middle and working class American taxpayers, have enjoyed real tax relief due to the 2017 tax cuts. Those tax cuts reduced federal tax rates for households across every income level, and this relief resulted in a tax cut of more than $1,500 for the average middle-income earner. In total, the Trump tax reform resulted in a $1.5 trillion net tax cut for America. These cuts were followed by historically low unemployment rates, an increase in business investment, and a $6,000 increase in real median household income over just 2 years, which included scores of raises and bonuses for workers immediately after the tax cuts were adopted. Those boosts for workers were caused primarily by the historic tax cuts made to business income taxes. Before these Trump tax cuts, the corporate income tax in America was nearly 40%, the highest among all developed nations across the world. That's right, America's tax rates on employers were higher than those in even France or Sweden. The 2017 tax relief made the corporate income tax a flat rate of 21%, bringing the United States back to the average among developed nations and dramatically enhancing American competitiveness. As we at the American Legislative Exchange Council frequently talk about in publications like our Rich States, Poor States, tax competitiveness is key to sustained economic growth. By lowering business taxes, the U.S. has taken steps to increase its competitive advantage over other nations, which was a huge factor in pre-pandemic economic growth. Some pundits will decry business tax cuts, of course, as a giveaway to the rich, but they forget one of the most essential lessons of tax policy. Businesses don't pay taxes, people pay taxes. And it turns out that generally it's workers and consumers that bear the burden of business taxes. But the Trump tax cuts didn't stop there. They also set an annual cap of $10,000 on the so-called state and local tax deduction, or SALT. Without the cap, the SALT deduction was extremely counterproductive to economic growth. That deduction, which has long been the holiest of sacred cows for the political left, allowed for the wealthiest of Americans living in high-tax states to deduct what they paid in state and local taxes from their federal taxes. This essentially subsidizes the high-tax states' decisions to be big government states at the expense of low-tax, limited government states, and it's a huge loss of potential revenue for federal coffers, which, of course, could be used to even cut income tax rates further and further spur economic growth. The $10,000 SALT deduction cap broadened the tax base at the federal level in many states, which caused state-level budget surpluses and resulted in many states offering substantial tax relief. The Trump tax cuts have been popular with the American people, and the cuts have spurred historic economic growth, benefiting all Americans at all income levels. Allowing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 to expire would result in a massive tax increase on hardworking American taxpayers, a significant decline in American competitiveness, fewer jobs, reduced wage income for workers, and even higher prices than we're seeing already today thanks to President Joe Biden's inflation. Permanently extending the Trump tax cuts would help the economy roar back to life and continue the economic growth and prosperity we saw pre-pandemic. Now, state legislators across the country are banding together to say, we need a permanent extension of the Trump tax cuts. For more information, visit ALEC.org or richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WROK-AM in Rockford, Illinois, along with KXEX-AM, KGED-AM, and KQEQ-AM, all in Fresno, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.